This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There's a report today from market researcher Realty Track that shows a 35% drop in foreclosure filings from a year ago. But analysts are quick to point out that many foreclosures may only be delayed, not averted. State and national foreclosure prevention efforts have picked up a little steam, but actually, it seems the main reason more people haven't been forced out of their homes is that foreclosure processing delays are becoming more numerous. Mortgage servicers are tied up in legal battles with homeowners, state governments, and investors. And after last decade's free fall in trading mortgage-backed securities, homeowners aren't even sure who holds their mortgages anymore. Adding a new wrinkle to this complex legal and financial landscape, insurance giant AIG this week filed a $10 billion lawsuit against Bank of America. AIG claims the Charlotte-based bank misrepresented the quality of mortgage-backed securities that AIG invested in. Adam O'Daniel joins us now. He's finance editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Hi, Frank. Thanks a lot.
Tell us about this lawsuit. What's going on?
Well, the gist of the lawsuit is similar to some of the other ones that we've seen, where AIG, like you said, is upset with the quality of the mortgage securities they bought from Bank of America and its predecessors, Merrill Lynch and largely Countrywide Financial, the giant home lender. And I guess the one of the things about the AIG suit is that they claim that there was some fraud that took place. The lawsuit claims that loan applications were doctored, that the marketing materials associated with these securities that they bought did not represent the individual loans that made up the securities. And so it's about $28 billion in securities, and they are asking for $10 billion in damages.
All right. And these securities all came about as a result of Bank of America's purchase of Countrywide that you mentioned earlier that really initially took on these basically bad loans.
Right. That's where the bulk of it comes from. And I think there's, you know, B of A did a little bit on their own. Merrill Lynch dabbled in it. But, you know, the bulk of Bank of America's mortgage problems right now come from that Countrywide Financial purchase back in 2008, because Countrywide was one of the nation's largest player in this mortgage securitization field.
So here's AIG saying that these mortgage-backed securities were not as good as you said they were, but AIG had a huge business in the decade that preceded this in insuring these very sorts of transactions, which had already begun to come undone. Surely they can't say they had no idea that this was a bag of worthlessness.
Yeah, I mean, that's the irony to all of this. If anybody should have known what was in these securities, you could say it would be AIG. I mean, they were the largest insurer of mortgage-backed securities. So they knew on that side of their business exactly what was going into these things, or at least you would think that they should have known. So, you know, that was Bank of America's response to this lawsuit this week. When you talk to their folks, is, look, AIG is a sophisticated investor. They should have known better.
That said, these things were kind of worthless. What's the actual particular claim? That when you talk about doctoring documents, that's different than saying, you know, there was a AAA rating. How should we know any better?
Right. Yeah. And so in this case, you know, one of the examples, and this is a huge lawsuit. I mean, it takes a lot of time to sift through all these documents and exhibits that were filed along with it. But, you know, one of the examples was, you know, someone who, you know, claims an income of X amount of dollars when really it was half that. Or they claim a business, you know, that had been established for so many years when that wasn't the case. You know, the fundamentals to establish their credibility for the loan just aren't true is what the accusation is.
And, of course, all of that goes back to the fundamentals of predatory lending that had been going on for a long time, and that was what was at the root of all of this. So this is going to make its way through the courts now.
That's right.
AIG is still 70% government-owned. Government presumably has a stake in this lawsuit. If AIG wins, does this mean some of the money goes back to the people?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure if we know how all that would play out, but certainly, you know, taxpayers do hold a majority stake in AIG still. So, you know, as taxpayers, we all kind of have a stake in this, I guess, don't we? Because it's, you know, if AIG wins, essentially, the taxpayer shareholders win along with it. On the other hand, Bank of America is the, you know, the largest bank by assets. It touches one in two households in the country. So if they lose, you can make an argument that a lot of Americans lose there too.
it's too big to fail all over again. So, so I'm going to take the risk here because I want to look at the chain of events and where these securities go. They were sold, they were resold, someone's left holding the bag, then there are lawsuits headed. I mean, does this mean that this is all headed sort of back up the chain again to help recoup the losses?
Yeah, there's some thought that, you know, this is, you know, another domino effect. You know, we saw back in 2008 that domino effect where individual mortgages made to individual people were made. They were packaged into securities. Those were sold to investors. Banks made a lot of money. Investors held these bonds. Now we're seeing the reverse. These bondholders are now suing the banks. We see the banks are, you know, feverishly working to foreclose on the bad mortgages. We have people who are desperately trying to save their homes. So, I mean, it's a domino chain that keeps going back and forth, and everybody is affected at some level.
Bank of America reached a settlement a few months ago with some of its investors who were suing for the pretty much for the same reason as AIG. What was that settlement, and why did Bank of America agree?
Well, that settlement was for $8.5 billion, and it was a group of 20-some investors. And the difference there is they were claiming that basically they just what they bought wasn't as advertised. AIG is taking it a step further and saying there was actual fraud that took place. But the heart of the matter is the same, in that these securities weren't as advertised. The problem with that $8.5 billion suit that we talked about, you know, a couple months ago, is that now it's being challenged by the attorney generals in New York and Delaware are challenging the suit. Other investors are challenging the suit, saying it wasn't a fair valuation of losses. $8.5 billion is not enough to cover what these investors lost, and that's going to end up winding through the courts and could be thrown out.
So it's interesting. You have a precedent on the one hand, Bank of America acknowledging at some level that there was that these securities were not as advertised. That's a pretty big acknowledgement. On the other hand, you get then people like attorneys general saying, yeah, but the amount simply wasn't enough.
Yeah, that's right. And B of A has maintained, you know, obviously for legal reasons, they never admit right or wrong in these settlements. You know, that's a common point in these corporate legal settlements is nobody admits whether they were right or wrong, but they pay the money to settle the claim. And in Bank of America's stance has been that $8.5 billion is a reasonable number to settle the claim. And on a conference call yesterday, the CEO, Brian Moynihan, said, when investors bring a reasonable claim, when they can come to a reasonable conclusion, he's happy to settle. In the case of AIG, he alluded to the fact that they don't think that's reasonable and they intend to fight it in court.
You talked about that conference call with investors. Bank of America's share price hasn't been doing well. What did Moynihan say to his investors? I'm assuming he says everything is fine.
He did. You know, he did a good job of trying to lay out the numbers and the case on a numbers basis of why Bank of America is in better shape today than it was in 2008 when it took a government bailout. And so, you know, he laid out the capital cushions they've built up, the $18 billion they have in reserves. On the other hand, a lot of analysts didn't think that he necessarily, you know, blew anybody's socks off with a ringing endorsement of the strategy and vision for the company. You know, that's the main thing with Bank of America that investors are concerned with is just the uncertainty of where the company goes from here and how it gets out of this big mess. And so, you know, from that standpoint, you know, there wasn't much that Brian Moynihan could say to calm those fears. He was kind of in a tough position. He did a good job of laying out the bank's case as he's done in previous presentations, but it's hard for him to answer those fears.
Certainly, some investors would like to see Bank of America put countrywide unit into bankruptcy. He wouldn't comment on that, would he?
No, he stayed away from that. That was one of the questions that was submitted and asked. Mr. Moynihan said that the bank has looked at all of the options. And they think that the course they're on is the best one. But he wouldn't comment specifically about a bankruptcy of Countrywide or that bad mortgage unit. But you're right. There are a lot of people that think that or something related to that is the only way to put this stuff in the past.
Now, we saw that businesses and corporate profits were doing pretty well. Bank of America is starting to trend in the other direction. Now, in the midst of this market turmoil and given these lawsuits that Bank of America faces, you have to ask the question, is there a chance Bank of America could go under?
Well, I think it might be premature to say that, you know, Bank of America would go under. You know, obviously, we've learned that Bank of America is too big to fail. So, you know, the government and the regulators are not going to let Bank of America just flounder and fail. That's not going to happen. You know, in a worst-case scenario, the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Bill has set up provisions where government agencies could step in and unwind assets, settle claims, and, you know, essentially peacefully save these giant institutions like Bank of America. But we're not really at a place where that's an imminent risk. But people are actually starting to think about, you know, kind of the what-if scenarios because of all the turmoil in the market.
What do Bank of America's troubles mean for Charlotte?
Well, in Charlotte, you know, Bank of America is a huge employer. It has huge influence on development in the city. And so anytime Bank of America is up or down, you know, sentiment in the city kind of follows that. People are in tune with what's going on with Bank of America. We have thousands of shareholders here in Charlotte, from folks who work at the bank or have had families, family members that work at the bank. And so it's a concern. Anytime Bank of America is not doing well, Charlotte takes notice.
Adam, thanks for laying all that out for us. Great help. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Adam O'Daniel, finance editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. On the state of things, we've been talking about AIG's lawsuit against Bank of America. Coming up, we're going to ask whether we're any closer to repairing the damage from that mortgage meltdown. On the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, it's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. This week's market turmoil has some analysts drawing frightening parallels to the financial crisis of 2008. That crisis began, of course, with the mortgage meltdown. The new lawsuit over mortgage-backed securities, filed by insurance giant AIG, against Bank of America shows that we are still slogging our way through the aftermath. Not only are millions of Americans' homes caught up in complex legal wrangling, investors who lost billions of dollars are still trying to figure out who to blame for their losses. Joining us in the studio to sort out some of these issues are Debbie Goldstein. She is Chief Operating Officer for the Center for Responsible Lending here in Durham. James Cox is a professor of corporate and securities law at Duke. And Alexander Arapoglu is a professor of the practice of finance at UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School and a board member of the Harrington Bank. I want to welcome all of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Debbie, let me start with you. This morning we heard about the foreclosure rate filings down 35% from a year ago, but apparently due mostly to processing delays. Has any progress been made on foreclosure prevention?
Well, I think, unfortunately, there's still millions of families that are in process for foreclosure. So since 2007, 7.5 million homes have entered the foreclosure process. Right now, there are about 4.2 million that are still currently in process. Borrowers can wait an average of more than 14 months to get a loan modification by working with their servicer. And I think an important thing to note is it's not just the families that are facing foreclosure that are affected by all of this. Every time there's a foreclosure in a neighborhood, it lowers the values of neighboring homes by about 1%. And those effects are cumulative. So the longer we take to address foreclosures, we're not just hurting those families. We're really making it much harder for people to sell their homes, even if they're current on their mortgage.
And this also has a ripple effect on tax values, the tax base, right? It all goes down. So municipalities are all suffering as this thing lingers. Talk about these delays, though, processing delays. What's happening?
I think servicers are really struggling to process foreclosures. And there's a lot of cases where we're seeing unnecessary foreclosures, where borrowers could probably qualify under a government program or even under private guidelines for a loan modification, where they could afford to make payments on their loan according to these guidelines. But they're getting trapped in the process. They call and they talk to one person one day, they talk to someone else the next day, or they apply for a loan modification. And while they're in the process of doing that and submitting the paperwork, the bank forecloses anyway.
And this is because I'm going to ask you to shift over just a little bit that way so that then when you turn your head, we're going to hear you full throat. This is in part because you might be talking to one part of the bank that's dealing with your foreclosure, and another part is racing to get the money out of that same home. They don't talk to each other.
That's right. I mean, unfortunately, most servicers were set up as debt collectors, right? So they're supposed to be collecting payments, and they actually are compensated as loans go into default. They are compensated for processing that loan through the system. They really don't have the capacity or the financial incentives to put the time-intensive work in to do a loan modification. And the system really just has not caught up with the level of foreclosures that we're at today.
Jim Cox, what is this lawsuit from AIG against Bank of America? Tell us about where we are in terms of working our way through the aftermath.
Well, I think this was a predictable response to the crisis. People lose money. They can't. They say they don't say why was I so stupid? They say instead I'm a victim, and they start talking to some smart lawyers. And AIG has probably one of the best law firms, if not the best law firm in America, looking at this case, which gives a lot of credibility. This is a firm. The law firm representing AIG is a firm that makes its money historically defending these suits, not bringing them. So, what we're finding here is that in the ashes, they start looking through things and finding out that there's massive deception. I think that the AIG was satisfied that 40% of the loans that were supposedly making up the various corpus of the investment vehicles were misrepresentations about, as was saying in the first segment of this program, about what people's salaries were, how long they've been in the construction industry. The story there was that the person said, I've been in the construction industry for 25 years, and if that's the case, they became a general contractor at age 10. there's massive defalcation of these documents. So as we find in crises, it takes a while for the legal process to move forward, and it is moving forward.
It's interesting because investors have brought suit as well. AI and Bank of America settled with some investors. This is where you focus your energy. Investors are in an interesting place because it's precisely to satisfy investor demand for quarterly profits that they were cooking the books and creating these fictions that became the mortgage meltdown. And now investors are saying, hey, what'd you do that for?
Yeah, we may think that the investors are perfectly diversified, that they were on the side of Bank of America, and they probably at one time also owned AIG. Now they don't own AIG anymore. They own Bank of America, and so they're going to lose yet again. And what's really sad about these lawsuits is that we do find that the repository for the losses are the people who own these companies and not the Ken Lewises of the world, whose hubris led them along the way to buy Countrywide when people were saying that's not a good idea. And also Merrill Lynch at a time when people were saying, and he knew that there was serious defalcations in the financial statements of Merrill Lynch on which the shareholders approved that without knowledge of those defalcations.
Interestingly enough, he thought he was getting a bargain, but it was the hedge fund owners who used those bargain rates to then sell them back, the mortgage-backed securities at full price when they had to sell them, when Bank of America had to sell at a discount.
And so just to complete the circle here about how the investors are getting the short stick on this, when the SEC brings a settlement and arrests a settlement of $150 million, none of that money was recovered from the responsible offers. In fact, it was recovered from the Bank of America shareholders who actually paid too much for Merrill Lynch, and now we're paying yet again to the government. So we have to contribute them for being saps and contributing to the deficit reduction.
Alex, if this AIG suit is successful, does it set a precedent about, sort of who's responsible? Does it say, yeah, this was garbage and we shouldn't have done it? I mean, is that a precedent?
Well, I think one of the advantages of these civil suits is that they help to clarify and delineate the responsibilities that all of the different parties have and how risk transfer takes place within the system. Many of these things are very subtle, and they're not obvious at first blush. Who is responsible? Who knew what, when, and so forth? And every one of these suits, by establishing a precedent, forces the different players to change how they go about doing business.
Will it have that effect, Debbie? Do you think that when all of this is finally settled, if it ever is, that it will result in more responsible lending?
I think we've already made progress on a number of fronts towards more responsible lending. So I think the suits in this case make a difference. I think we've also seen examples. For example, the Massachusetts Attorney General has brought some suits against the original makers of the loans for making unfair loans. And then, of course, a really important component of the Dodd-Frank Act that was enacted was that it put in place very strong underwriting standards for mortgage origination going forward and banned many of the abusive loan products that put borrowers at risk in the first place. And so now the critical thing is to implement those protections and make sure that they're enforced, which would mean putting the CFPB in place, having a director confirmed and letting it do its job.
CFPB is?
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was also created as part of the Dodd-Frank Act.
Now, part of the problem there with enforcement is the funding and the actual structure of these enforcement agencies that have frankly been dismantled along the way, right?
Right. So one of the problems during the previous several years is that the banking supervisors really didn't do enough to curb some of the abusive practices that were happening, which is one of the reasons the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created under the Dodd-Frank Act. But now there's a real attempt to stop that agency before it can even start working. So there are a lot of attempts to undermine its funding, and there's been resistance to confirming a director so that the bureau can start taking action.
I think one of the questions we have to ask is what the lessons are that are learned by the regulators from this process. I think that's really the line of first defense. Debbie was just mentioning the role of the regulators. They actually contributed significantly to a lot of the mortgage problems. You found that a rule that was issued by the Comptroller of the Currency had the effect of preempting laws in a number of states, including Nevada and Arizona, which are the two highest foreclosure markets, preempting state laws that would have reduced the amount of subprime mortgage lending that was going on and the predatory lending that was going on. So government was very complicit. I say that as somebody who's a great admirer of government, but the real question is what lessons have been learned here. The government includes not just the regulatory agencies, but also includes the Congress as well, which was encouraging Fannie and Freddie to go out on the risk curve to expand mortgages for a variety of social issues. And so that exacerbated the problem. So we need to hope that the message that is being learned here was first learned, I think, by regulators so they can provide the meaningful watchdog role that we have to have.
Well, and both parties were complicit in this. I mean, it was Bill Clinton's CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission chair, who first pointed this out and in 1998 recommended changes so that these mortgage-backed securities wouldn't go viral and do the damage they did. And she was ultimately ousted for her efforts in the Clinton administration. So both parties are playing a part, and as you said, government not playing its role, would you say? I mean, it's not that the government isn't doing it. It's that it's backing away from this.
Exactly.
Well, one of the issues, funding is a very big issue in terms of how effective the regulatory agencies are. It's a known fact that our, for example, central bankers earn maybe a half of what their equivalents in Europe earn, maybe a third of what the heads of the central banks in places like Singapore earn. And while that doesn't have consequences for the people at the top, it has consequences for what staff they're able to recruit and the quality of regulations that emerge and policy that emerges from those institutions.
It's interesting that our central banker is relatively lower to European standards, but CEOs are far, far and away higher and better paid than their European counterparts.
It's a real problem. What you see as a consequence is a lot of people working within the regulatory agencies, for example, in enforcement functions, staying for a few years, gaining experience, not making any waves, and then moving on to work for the corporations themselves. So that's an issue, I think, that needs to be addressed in the long term.
Questions of conflict of interest, of course, very important in this whole story. Jim Cox, one of the things that's striking about the lawsuit from AIG against Bank of America is that it throws those conflicts of interest into pretty stark relief. Can Bank of America be expected to service its mortgage holders well when its first and foremost responsibility is to shareholders?
Well, you find that one of the most distinguishing characteristics of banking, and particularly investment banking, which Bank of America now is more of an investment bank than just a sort of corner bank, is that they're riddled with conflicts of interest. And so when you start engaging in a transaction with your bank, my guess is that the best advice I can give you is hang on to your wallet because at the end of the day, their goal is to make money for their shareholders, okay? And I'm not sure that that's really the goal. It may be to make money for their bonuses, given the fact that people like Goldman Sachs, 40% of their revenues go to bonuses to employees. And as a result, I think your interests and maybe even the shareholders' interests get trodden down by the self-interest that riddles throughout the organization.
These conflicts of interest, Alex, are particularly insidious when investment banks serve the public sector. You have spoken about this and been involved in some cases in which municipalities or public pension funds end up paying out massive fees to Wall Street. Tell us about this.
Well, there have been some instances where people are paying very high prices for derivatives relative to market. And then these derivatives might not actually provide the type of insurance that the end users have been looking forward to. At the end of the day, they're taking advice from the investment banks in order to structure the transactions. And yet the banks are saying, well, you know, I know that in this capacity we act as your advisor, but when we were talking about the derivatives, you're dealing with us at arm's length. And therefore, as you've said, Jim, you have to know who you're talking to, because in one department, you're dealing with a trusted advisor, and then you move to the next department, and you're dealing at arm's length, and nobody holds up a sign to tell you when.
Can you break that down? In terms of municipalities, I'd like to sort of follow that transaction and show where the conflict is. If you could kind of break that down for me as a layman.
Well, to begin with, if you're doing something like an interest rate swap and the market for interest rate swaps, the commercial market is 1 or 2 basis point. A basis point is 1/100 of 1%. You might be charged as much as 50 basis points because you don't have the ability as an end user to know. There isn't the transparency, and this is something that Dodd-Frank is trying to address, but at the moment there isn't the transparency for you to know what you're paying. So if somebody comes to you and says, well, you can do this transaction with me at no cost, you might think, oh, I'm not paying those 50 basis points. And later on you find out that at no cost means no upfront cost. You just pay over time.
You pay over time. And so right. Municipalities have found themselves in this bind where they got some kind of a bait and switch or no down payment and we'll get it on the back end. And now they want to get out of it. It's costing them a lot of money.
Well, it's worse than that, because what they've often done is to get involved in variable rate demand bonds. And these variable rate demand bonds are bonds that extend for 20 years, but they have to be refinanced monthly or weekly. They have to be resold monthly or weekly. When the financial crisis came about, many of these bonds could no longer be resold, and the municipalities had to find alternative means of financing. Mm. But at the same time as interest rates went up to infinity on the variable rate demand bonds and they could no longer be sold, interest rate swap rates went down because the government bailed out the banks. Mm. And because government bonds went down in terms of yield. So what's happened is the municipalities ended up getting stuck with the interest rate swaps and with large breakage fees on a product which basically didn't work.
And what's the story about getting out of those? That's a pretty expensive venture too.
Well, again, the banks have said if we were this has moved in our favor and you have to pay perhaps millions of dollars in order to get out of these transactions, despite the fact that in some instances they didn't work.
Debbie Goldman, we talked about Dodd-Frank, the problems in funding. The fact is that it's got a legal mechanism but no enforcement body to really get behind it and make the changes. There was another law called the Glass-Steagall Law that would have prevented a lot of this, would it not? And that put some of the partitions up so that bankers couldn't open one window over here and then be working in another business on the other side of their building that was actually working against your best interest.
Well, right. So that was in place. And in addition, there were also many other tools available to prevent some of these mortgages from being made in the first place. So, for example, the Federal Reserve had authority for over 10 years to say that some mortgage terms were unfair and deceptive or were violations of credit laws. But the Federal Reserve chose not to be aggressive about taking new mortgage terms and saying these terms are gonna harm homeowners.
Do we need to get back to some of that legislation? Is Dodd-Frank enough? And do we need to return to some of the regulation we had?
I think on the mortgage origination front, Dodd-Frank put in place some really strong new protections that limit the ability of lenders to make risky loan products, and also really require them to look at the borrower's ability to repay the loan and to document their income. I think those are very basic standards that Dodd-Frank put in place. There is another risk, which is that we'll overcorrect in other areas. So one big concern that's coming out of Dodd-Frank is that regulators have also started arguing that perhaps we should have very large down payment requirements for home mortgages going forward. And unfortunately there, I think it's pretty clear from empirical research that low down payment loans were not the problem. The problem were risky loans with features like rapidly adjusting rates, with exploding mortgage payments that adjusted quickly, as well as prepayment penalties that made it hard to pay off. But we're at risk of cutting a lot of people out of the mortgage market if we now overcorrect by imposing regulation of down payments.
I wish we had more time. We will revisit this. So for now, I want to thank all of you for being on the program.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Debbie Goldstein is Chief Operating Officer for the Center for Responsible Lending here in Durham. Jim Cox is a Professor of Corporate and Securities Law at Duke. And Alexander Arapoglu is a Professor of the Practice of Finance at UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School. Coming up on the State of Things, Clyde Edgerton on his new book, The Night Train. Stay with us.